Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, do the high-profile cases like the Teamsters, the UPS workers, unionization at Starbucks and Amazon signal a new labor awakening in America? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Labor discontent is rising in the post-pandemic economy. Teamsters recently won pretty significant concessions in light of a strike threat against UPS. Los Angeles, where this show is based, has two different strikes rocking the city. Hollywood strikes against the studios are well known, but also hotel workers are on strike, with increasing numbers of hotel properties facing picket lines. And of course, stories about unionization at huge corporations, including Starbucks and Amazon, have captured headlines. But a reminder that a very small percentage of American workers actually are in a union. In 2022, that number was at 10.1%, a slight decrease from the previous year. So on today's show, we explore the state of labor in the United States and what these current labor disputes means for the future of unions. Our panel today is Lane Windham, Associate Director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. She's the author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s, and the Roots of a New Economic Divide, and co-author of Explaining the Erosion of Private Sector Unions. John Logan is professor and chair of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. He's the author of Crushing Unions by Any Means Necessary, How Amazon's Blistering Anti-Union Campaign Won in Bessemer, Alabama, and very recently published A Model for Labor's Renewal, The Starbucks Campaign. And Leon Fink is distinguished professor in the Department of History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's the author of Workers Across the Americas, The Transnational Turn in Labor History, and In Search of the Working Class, Essays in American Labor History and Political Culture. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. Lane Windham, I'll start with you. Unions have been in the news quite a bit recently, and in particular, the Teamster settlement with UPS was signaling a lot of analysis that unionization is back and that unions are on the rise. Are they?
Well, I think certainly what we saw in the strike threat at UPS is that workers are claiming and exercising their power. We are definitely in the middle of what some are calling hot labor summer. I think that coming off of the pandemic, there are new ideas about workers and workers' rights. The polling shows that unions are very popular, more popular than they've been in decades. And I think that workers are exercising that power. So we've seen that certainly at UPS, but of course, hey, we've got actors on strike. We had graduate employees and the entire California system recently on strike. And of course, hotel workers and even Starbucks workers struck what they called their pride strikes to strike for the right to honor Pride Month. And so we are definitely seeing workers on the move across the country.
And John Logan, I know, especially since Lane Windham just referenced Starbucks, I know you've written about Starbucks recently. Is the Starbucks unionization campaign, I would imagine we label that as a success. How glowing of a success has that been for unionization?
Right. Well, I mean, the Starbucks campaign has achieved something that, you know, it sounds hyperbole, but I'm not sure any union has previously achieved in U.S. history, certainly not since the 1930s and 1940s. I mean, it won against a multi-billion dollar corporation that will do anything to crush unionization, but it didn't win once. It's won over 320 times now. So, you know, it created this sort of replicable model that sort of showed that it actually was possible to organize at these types of companies. You know, so when you ask, is labor on the rebound? Is labor making a comeback? I mean, I think, you know, there's several different things going on. First, as I said, you know, you've had these remarkable union victories at Starbucks, at Amazon, at Trader Joe's, at REI, at Barnes & Noble, at Chipotle, at Apple retail stores. So all of these big retailers and billion-dollar companies where unions have never, ever succeeded before. And you know, this has had enormously energizing effect on the labor movement nationally, but particularly amongst young workers. Young workers at the moment are deeply attracted to the idea of organizing their own workplace. They're not particularly deeply attracted to the labor establishment. I mean, you know, most of them could probably never tell you who the president of the AFL or the president of SEIU was. But there's something deeply appealing about organizing their own workplace. And we see that all over, you know, all over the place. Another thing, though, that these campaigns have done is they've put the issue of the right to organize and corporate coercion in the front pages of the news. Not like once or twice, but day after day after day, month after month after month. And so that's important for two reasons, the media and the social media coverage. I mean, first, this is how young workers find out about these campaigns. It's how they're inspired to try to organize their own workplaces. And second, it means that there's far more people paying attention who are engaged with labor issues at the moment. And that is vitally important. You know, if there's ever going to be a possibility, I mean, you started off by pointing out quite rightly that union membership continues to decline 10% nationally, 6% in the private sector. And we know that that's going to be the case. And that is going to continue unless we can get stronger labor rights. But there's no possibility, I would say, of getting stronger labor rights unless people are engaged with the issues, unless they understand the issues. So the media focus on campaigns like Starbucks and Amazon has given a sort of vividness and a concreteness to the fight over union representation that never existed before. I mean, the labor movement nationally is kind of hopeless at communication. And you know, that's why things like labor law remain a black box for most people. But this is sort of starting to chip away at that and break down about it. And I'm going to stop there, but I think like with UPS too, I mean, I would love to talk about what's happening with the Teamsters Union and the UAW and some of the other unions where we see a new sort of bolder, more militant leadership that's sort of unapologetic about taking on corporate greed and using union influence to get a better deal for their workers and for American workers more generally. And I think the new president of the Teamsters, Sean O'Brien, sort of epitomizes that approach. And, you know, I think when you think, well, what do you need from a union leader in a moment like we have today? I think O'Brien, you know, ticks a lot of the boxes. And I think, you know, that was really, you know, it was really an exemplary, you know, way to conduct contract negotiations and get a better deal. And, you know, and I think we will see more of that in other industries.
And Leon Fink, I want to bring you in because I know you've written about political culture, and John Logan made some of these references to the way in which we view unions within a political culture. Is this having any sort of an impact on the way people who aren't serving in unions view unions generally? I mean, there was this period where unions were seen as being predatory, they're taking your wages, they were corrupt leadership, etc. But it seems like the culture might be shifting on that.
Doug, I think that's right. I think that there has been a shift, at least measured by polls, but whether the general opinion how much it's changed, I don't know that that matters that much. It's a question of how is the public involved, if at all, in the resolution of workers' grievances. And I completely agree with both Lane and John that what we're witnessing is what we might even call something akin to a great upheaval among American workers. The epicenter is likely California and the country as a whole. I mean, there's no place where there's more activism. And it seems by other measures as well that corporate authority is at a low ebb in terms of its the sense of confidence that Americans have in in big business and in corporate authority, whether it's Elon Musk or anyone else. But how that translates, Doug, to the question of workers' power, to the how things will settle out for unions as a source, as a kind of countervailing power in the culture is another question. And there we run into issues of the structure of the law and industrial relations in this country that are not so easy to predict, or it certainly are chock full of problems. I mean, it seems like, you know, where this upheaval has had great effect already in a few established areas of union strength, like the Teamsters and in UPS. And you have to kind of break that down, I think, into specific industries and terrains. UPS is fighting with FedEx for market share. It doesn't want to lose that, the share that it has. And part of its share is also based on the fact that it is a collective bargaining center, unlike FedEx. So it clearly decided not to try to break the union. Other companies, workers in other companies don't have it that way. In some other areas of union strength are those areas that seem where employers are most susceptible to not only workers, but public pressure. And the UCAL system strike in the spring, a tremendous breakthrough for workers in higher education, is a good example of that. You know, left to the public and left to the workers, I think there's a strong pro-union tide right now. But in other areas where companies, where employers continue to hide behind extremely adverse laws that basically do not compel, and in some ways even you could say encourage delay refusal to bargain, we see a lack of contracts, you know, a refusal to actually sign a contract, even where the workers have been recognized and where there's strong pro-worker sentiment, such as at the Amazon breakthrough in Staten Island, or the hundreds of Starbucks stores. None of them have resulted in union contracts. And that's why the percentage that you cited is still so woeful. So I think the country has a lot of big issues ahead of it. The labor movement has some key strategic decisions ahead of it. But nevertheless, I agree with my counterparts here that something exciting is going on.
Now, Lane Wyndham, one of the things that strikes me about a lot of these stories is that, you know, has been the unionization in areas that are kind of new for unions, a lot more service sector, you know, the impact in places like Amazon and Starbucks. But I actually want to turn to UPS here, because in that case, that's a really kind of traditional union battle. Is when you think of strong unions, Teamsters immediately come to mind. The success that the Teamsters had at UPS, how much of that is potentially industry-wide or even economy-wide, and how much of it was just kind of unique to the fact that UPS was one of these rare companies that was actually pretty vulnerable to unions in ways, to labor unrest in ways that other companies aren't?
No, it's a fascinating question, and it's actually a good question to have with this group, because you've got three historians here. And, you know, there definitely are times when we see that workers will strike in the industry that is key to tying everything together in that economic moment, right? Sort of the core industry in that historical moment's infrastructure. So, you know, Leon a minute ago referenced the great upheaval. This was actually, you know, a great railway strike in 1877, 1886, right? We also had major strikes in the auto industry in the 1930s, 1940s. So for our moment, when so much of our economy is strung together through through the shipping, through the channels, the distribution channels, it is interesting that UPS ended up being sort of this pivotal industry where the workers were able to credibly put forward a strike. And when, let's talk for a moment about what they actually won. They won gains for part-time workers. This is a fight they had been fighting since 1997 when they went on strike around the issue of part-time workers. They made gains at that time, but still much of the workforce remained part-time and lower paid. And so part of what they were doing is throwing down the gauntlet and demanding better for those part-time workers. So it is very interesting that we saw this strike threat happening in this core key industry. Now, of course, we do have another potential strike coming up in September because the big three and the UAW, the big three automakers and the UAW, their contract is up September 14th. And so, you know, that also could be a major strike. You know, even though it is true that we have seen lots of activity among retail workers, among service workers, and now in the entertainment industry with writers and actors, there are certainly these core industries that continue to wield a lot of power.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the state of labor in the United States with Lane Windham of Georgetown University, John Logan of San Francisco State University, and Leon Fink of the University of Illinois at Chicago. And John, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, just a quick word on UPS. I mean, I think the significance of UPS is that it does have the potential for setting the tone for private sector negotiations. Not every company is like UPS, but, you know, Sean O'Brien and the Teamsters have really shown a sort of model that you can actually, you know, as O'Brien said, you know, stand up against corporate greed, get a better deal for American workers. And, you know, as Lane was saying, you know, they got a better deal for part-time workers, for full-time workers. They created more full-time jobs. They did away with the hated two-tier contracts that were negotiated in 2018. So O'Brien came to the leadership of the Teamsters 2 years ago because he'd broken over an awful contract the Teamsters had negotiated with UPS in 2018. And it was very clear at that time, as he said repeatedly, that the Teamsters had two priorities. One was to negotiate a much better contract with UPS, that the time for contract for concessions was over. And second was to take on Amazon. And so, again, you know, as I was saying before, I mean, you have to think about what do you need in terms of a union leader in today's era when so many young people in particular are crying out for bolder leadership amongst union leaders. And what O'Brien did, and I thought he did it very well, is first he's breathed new life into the Teamsters as a union. I mean, under the old regime, the Teamsters was not the union that it is today. I mean, O'Brien has gone around the country. He's met with rank and file workers, you know, particularly UPS workers. He had them strike ready. He had them practice picketing. He did all of this stuff to make sure that, you know, the strike threat at UPS was a credible threat. I mean, second, he went on national news, Good Morning America, Fox News, Bloomberg, everywhere, day after day after day. And he was very good. He had a very clear message that this is about corporate greed, this is about part-time poverty, and this is about getting a better deal for American workers, not just at UPS, but throughout the entire country. And that's what we need, you know, as I say, at the particular moment, we have so few union leaders that ever do that and frankly are capable of doing it. Sarah Nelson of the flight attendants would be an exception too, that she's developed a national platform despite the fact that she leads a relatively small union. And third, as I said, was the message. And the message was really important that, as I said, he was saying, this is about corporate greed. If you look at UPS profits, this is about, you know, doing away with part-time poverty. This is about being unapologetic about confronting American corporations to get a better deal for American workers. And that message really, really did get through. So I think, you know, O'Brien has been inspirational in that sense. Just very briefly back to this question of, well, you know, does public opinion matter? Does it matter that 71% of the American public say they approve of unions? Much higher rates, incidentally, amongst young workers, where it's, you know, close to 80%, which is extraordinarily high by the standard of these types of polls. I would say it does matter. It matters a lot. It's the highest level since 1965. And it's that high despite unions' organizational weakness, despite the fact that today unions only represent 6% in the private sector. I mean, absolutely, Liam is right that, you know, we're never going to get millions of new union members if we don't have stronger labor rights, if we don't have stronger protection for the right to organize. But when you go back to the Obama administration and think, you know, why didn't the Employee Free Choice Act, the last effort to reform labor laws, make them, you know, to strengthen the right to form a union, why didn't it stand a chance? Well, you know, I would say three things. First, there was nothing going on in the ground. There was no equivalent of Starbucks Workers United, Amazon Labor Union. There was no sense of excitement and enthusiasm and optimism amongst young workers that you have, you can see evidence of everywhere today. Second, you could never even meet someone who didn't have a professional interest, who'd heard of the Employee Free Choice Act. No one was engaged with labor issues. No one understood labor issues. So as I said before, these campaigns have helped put them on the front pages. And third, you know, Obama didn't lift a finger to help it. But given the first two, it was inevitable that he was never going to lift a finger to help it. So, I mean, that's just to say all of that does matter. It really does matter that young workers are energized at the moment and that they're attracted to the idea of organizing their own workplaces. It really does matter that there's an enormous public appetite for these stories of union campaigns at Starbucks and Amazon and what's happening at UPS. And I think the problem, I mean, you know, the problem of the financial might and, you know, the companies like Starbucks and Amazon will fight to the death to prevent their workers from organizing. That's always going to be the case. Unfortunately, that's the system we have in America. But the other problem is that the labor establishment, for want of a better term, has largely been missing in action as most of this has taken place. You know, most of these organizing campaigns, Starbucks, Amazon, Trader Joe's, et cetera, have been REI, I would say, too. The RWDSU has had many great campaigns, but you know, it's an exception. Most of the really big unions have not been engaged, have not been helping to the extent that we would want them to. And I would say even feel threatened by the nature of these campaigns in some ways. So I do think it has been a sort of monumental failure on the part of the labor establishment over the past 2 years to capitalize on this moment. And of course, the primary problem is the weakness of the law and the strength of a corporate opposition. But that's not going to change. I mean, that's the way it is right now. So, you know, we need to take advantage of moments like this when they arise. And as I'm not sure that, you know, there's a possibility that we're just sort of, you know, the best moment we've had in decades that might, all this promise could just be, you know, pissed away, forgive my, and, you know, in 5 years' time, we don't know what the legacy of it will be. So, I mean, I think that is a worry.
And Leon Fink, seems like the image that we have here is that we've got more organization, more public support for unions. There definitely seems to be a bit of a generational shift. I mean, millennials and Gen Z are much more likely to be supportive, you know, of unions, but we have a legal system that's really quite protective of corporations in their negotiations, you know, with labor. So I kind of come back to the political culture question. You have this groundswell of support, but this potentially massive means to suppress because the labor laws aren't necessarily on the side of unions. First of all, is that an accurate description? And secondly, how do we change it if it is?
I think it is indeed, but, and, you know, going back to, the last great upheaval, probably we could say, was in the 1930s, and Elaine mentioned one earlier in the late 19th century as well. But, you know, at the beginning of the move that would eventuate in the rise of industrial unionism and like the CIO, the unions drew on a phrase, you know, that put words in Franklin Roosevelt's mouth, but that the president wants you to join a union. And that made a difference. The change over and the emphasis of the political regime. It's interesting that at least his own handlers have wanted to call President Biden the most pro-union president since Franklin Roosevelt. And that, you know, to the extent that that's might be true, it's a kind of pathetic comment on the Democratic Party in the intervening years. But the fact is that the Democratic Party, even when it's been in power, as fragmented as our national or federal system has been, has failed, as John said, to enact any meaningful labor, significant labor reform that would change the tilt against unions, and particularly any pressure to actually turn union victories in the organizing stage into contracts. There's no way to force currently companies to use arbitration. That's not in the books. It is in Europe. In most other countries, there is another agent of labor peace, and that is the state itself in one form or another, public representatives, but not generally speaking in this country. But in terms of the political culture, I'd come back to one other complicating aspect that to John's point. John makes a good, I think, I wouldn't quarrel at all. I agree with his praise for someone like O'Brien at the Teamsters as a visionary leader. But one thing the Teamsters have that most other unions don't have is a national contract, a national platform. So much of the rest of American labor, the terrain is fragmented. So the situation facing teachers in Mississippi is very different from what it is in New York City. Same with many other groups of workers. And so it's hard to put together a national campaign in most industries, I would say. In addition, though, I think a factor, the UPS, by and large, and the Teamsters were able pretty much to pull off their victory on their own power. I mean, they did appeal to the public, as John says, but in other cases, it's even more crucial that there be more union community ties if they're going to succeed. And I think one positive example besides the Teamsters is Local 11 of Unite Here in LA and beyond, where hotel and restaurant workers have put together a powerful community and labor movement that reaches into into political power as well in the state of California. And that's a model that I think needs to be replicated one way or another if we're going to move forward.
When we come back, is California the new ground zero for labor organizing? And if so, what does this suggest about the political climate for labor? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Labor organizers are using a large range of issues, including women's rights, LGBTQ representation and pride, and environmental activism to attract new members. Is this changing the conceptual divide between culture war issues, the environment, and economic issues? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Lane Windham, Associate Director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University, John Logan, Professor and Chair of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State University, and Leon Fink, Distinguished Professor in the Department of History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. So, John, Logan, you, like me, are out here in California, and when you think of labor organization, California seems to be sort of at the forefront of this. I know in Los Angeles made the reference to the hotel workers and of course to the Hollywood strikes. Is California kind of the ground zero for a lot of this organization? And if so, is it really Is it because it's a liberal state, or is there something about union organization in California that puts it in a sort of leading role?
I would actually push back a little bit on that idea. I'm not sure California is at the forefront. I mean, when you look at, you know, union membership in California, like in almost every other state that has public sector collective bargaining, we have very high rates of public sector collective bargaining, not as high as New York State, which has over 70%. But, you know, we have in the sort of mid-50s. And when it comes to private sector bargaining, the position is much more dire. I mean, California is in a better position than nationally, but not that much better. And if you look at almost all of the organizing, a huge part of the organizing that's gone on in California over the past 2-3 decades, it's either where it's the public sector, or I would call almost sort of quasi-public sector, places where unions have been able to exercise political influence to help them organize. So among some types of healthcare workers, amongst home care workers, amongst, at the moment, UFCW in California is doing very well at organizing pot workers, marijuana workers. But again, the new politics comes into play here. The same is true in hotel workers. You know, generally, Unite here, the hotel union, has been very, very good at putting local political pressure before major hotel projects come about to get the insertion of labor peace ordinances into construction to the agreements that the cities make with private companies. And so this gives them an added advantage when it comes to, but if you just look at pure private sector organizing, actually California's not that different from the rest of the country. And the reason is, as we've said before, it's really, really, really difficult to organize in the private sector today. If you have a company like Starbucks, like Amazon, that has almost unlimited cash and is prepared to do whatever is necessary in order to crush its workers' efforts to join a union, it will be successful in the vast majority of cases. But the remarkable thing is that, you know, there have been cases where it hasn't been successful in recent years. And indeed, you know, what the Starbucks campaign showed, and of course, Starbucks is a very particular type of company, but what it showed is they won in North Carolina, in South Carolina, in Florida, in Alabama, in, you know, Arkansas. They won in place in Kansas where unions never, ever win in the private sector. And people say, well, but these are small workplaces. But really, it's, I mean, that's totally missing the point. I mean, at this stage, you know, when you're as deep a hole as American unions are in the private sector today, numbers almost don't matter. I mean, it wouldn't make that much difference if they organized every single Starbucks store in the country and got a contract for every one of them. It would have no difference in terms of the trajectory of private sector union membership in the United States. But their campaign had the ability to inspire young workers all across the country. So, I mean, I would point out two things. I mean, we've said this before, but what's really striking about so many of these union organizing campaigns, whether it be Starbucks, Trader Joe's, REI, Apple, or whether it be cultural workers, you know, museum workers, gallery workers, or nonprofit workers, or graduate students, and now undergraduate student workers all across the country. It's really young workers who are at the forefront of these organizing campaigns. Now, I would say for two reasons. One, frustrated economic expectations. These are young people who entered the job market after the Great Recession, can't afford to buy a house, can't afford to pay off student loans, can't even afford to get a living wage in most of the cities in which they live. Second, they're politicized in a way that previous generations of young workers have not been, either through Bernie's presidential campaigns, Black Lives Matter, abortion rights issues, environmental issues, LGBTQ issues, which are vitally important in the Starbucks campaign. So all of those things have, I think, made them more skeptical about the brutal side of American capitalism. And then, you know, you add to that that they worked through the pandemic and the way they were treated by the companies that they worked for during the pandemic. So young workers, I mean, Noam Schieber had a great piece in the New York Times about a year ago when he called it the revolt of the college-educated working class. And I think in some ways that does sum up the types of workers who have been at the forefront of many of these organizing campaigns, including my own students, you know, and I teach at a primarily working class, first generation student of color university, where students, my students, have been involved in organizing at Trader Joe's, at Starbucks, at other, and on the CSU campus now, undergraduate workers. The second thing that's very noticeable is that many of the companies in which the new organizing has been taking place are companies that in the public mind have progressive reputations. So if you think of Starbucks, if you think of Trader Joe's, if you think of Apple, if you think of REI, if you think of Ben and Jerry's workers organized in Burlington, Vermont a couple of months ago, all of these companies have progressive reputations. Now, of course, as we've learned with Starbucks and Trader Joe's and most of the others, with the exception of one exception of Ben and Jerry's, that progressive reputation does not translate into respect for union rights. But what it does mean is that they attract workers who want to work for that company because of their support for LGBTQ rights and environmental justice and Black Lives Matter. And again, these are precisely the kinds of workers who at the moment, as I said, have this very powerful attraction to organizing their own workplace, not to the labor establishment, but you know, they want a voice at work. They want to be able to do it themselves. And what they need from the labor movement is someone that will give them the tools that they need to succeed. And so tell them, you know, as worked in the Starbucks campaign, this is how it spread so rapidly in the first 6 to 8 months when the campaign really was a sort of model campaign. I would say it probably no longer is in some ways, but, you know, that's a different debate. But what happened was, you know, people heard about the organizing in Buffalo. They reached out to the campaign by, you know, Twitter, by, you know, Facebook Messenger, by, you know, text message, whatever it is, and said, I want to do this in my store. Can you teach me how to do it? And they were set up with a Zoom meeting and with a person, a young worker who had organized in Buffalo, and said, yes, we can teach you how to do this in your store. We can give you the tools that you need to succeed. And so you need people like that, you know, who will breathe life into these campaigns, who will sort of will them into existence, because, you know, companies like Starbucks and Trader Joe's and Amazon will never willingly cease unilateral control of the workplace. They just won't. They're not going to do it. They're not going to give it up. So, I mean, this, you know, the reason I say Starbucks is a model is that Starbucks by itself, Starbucks Workers United, is not going to revive the labor movement. But a lot of it's going to rely on this sort of dynamic of self-organization. And so we need dozens of more campaigns just like that one, and for it to continue to spread and for other young people to read about them, to be inspired by them, to want to do the same.
So Lane Wyndham, I think there was a point there about this being the rise of the college-educated underpaid working poor. And I think, you know, your institute that advocates for and studies the working poor. So how much is this unionization driven by kind of the nature of the economy, where students are encouraged, go to school, get a degree, by the way, maybe with a large student loan that they have to pay off at the end of that. And then, you know, graduating into, I mean, when I think of Starbucks, a lot of new college grads end up working for Starbucks, you know, for a while. And so as a result, I guess the question here is the way this, you know, has been framed, this is a very different labor movement than one that would be focused on manufacturing, non-college educated, and even kind of a career path where the expectation is you would work that same job for 30, 40 years. A lot of these jobs aren't that way, right?
It's true that there are lots of people organizing and striking who are college graduates, but it's a diverse group. If you actually look at the National Labor Relations Board elections and see where the elections are being held, although Starbucks, you know, those get a lot of the press attention, there's lots of organizing also happening at hospitals and sanitation departments and all across the board. Now, you asked a question earlier about LA, and I want to just point out that you asked, is there something special about the the, you know, union activism in LA. Well, let's think about who's actually striking, who's actually organizing there, right? It's lots of women. It's lots of people of color. Think about that hotel housekeeper strike, right? That is lots of women and people of color. We have, we have a woman who is leading the SAG-AFTRA strike. We see that women have been key within the Starbucks campaign, within the university campaigns. And I just want to remind us that even before the pandemic, we saw 2 years of the largest strike waves in this country in 2018 and 2019 that we've seen since the early 80s. And these were driven in large part by teachers. Leon mentioned teachers a minute ago. We had 485,000 workers strike in 2018. 450,000 in 2019. This was, if people remember, the Red for Ed, right? All those teachers were striking in places that we don't think of, like LA, right? They were in Oklahoma, North Carolina, Kentucky. And I think that what we are seeing at this moment is a broad surge of activism. And I think John hit on it when he listed some of these other movements. We're living through a elevated moment of rights consciousness, and people's rights as workers are part of that. People are also very aware about their rights in terms of gender, in terms of race, in terms of sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, for young workers especially, they don't accept the one bucket or the other. For them, it's all the lived experience, right? We have been talking about how difficult it is for workers to actually win unions. You know, Leon was saying, and John was saying, all these workers at Starbucks, we've seen this amazing suite of union election after election after election, but nobody has a contract. And nobody is yet a union member. Well, how could that be? I think most people in the public would be shocked. What? Those people aren't union members? Well, they're not, because you're not actually a union member until you get a union contract. And the companies are doing everything they can to drag their feet, to stall, to resist actually signing a union contract. And they will continue to do so. And in some cases, they're doing so illegally, and sometimes they're doing so legally. They're skirting the law, and sometimes they are staying within the law. And so ultimately, I believe that in order for that to change, the young people, the women, the people of color, the whole diverse group who is driving this new union activism, this new upsurge, is going to have to, over probably a number of years, is going to have to drive through a major change in the way that we do labor, the way we do workers' rights in this country. We have a messed up system where people have to go through a very, very, very narrow door in order to become a union member. We're going to have to blow that up, and it's going to have to be the young generation that demands a new way of earning their rights, of being union members, and envisioning a union movement that is inclusive, that is broad, and that can build power probably well beyond what current labor law allows.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the current state of labor in the United States with Lane Wyndham of Georgetown University, John Logan of San Francisco State University, and Leon Fink of the University of Illinois at Chicago. And Leon, you wanted to respond to this as well.
Yeah, no, I wanted to just add to Lane's useful emphasis on the nature, the demography of this great upheaval. That, and she emphasized, I mean, John mentioned youth. Lane mentioned gender and women in particular in the leadership. I want to just put on the table, make explicit that another key feature of this, I think, is immigrants, no more so than in California, important works by Mike Davis a few years ago showed the centrality of a maturing immigrant population and leadership in California is really the backbone of men and women are the backbone of the rise of powerful movements, especially in Southern California, which was once anti-union territory. But people like Maria Elena DeRosso, who's now in the state Senate, this is a kind of politicized union clout that I don't know that we see almost anywhere else in the country. And I think it does augur well, I mean, as a model for a way to go forward. But I want to also just throw on the table another factor that it's not only in the issues of union rights at the workplace that worker standard of living and basic rights are either denied or insured. The labor movement, but in addition to winning legalization for millions of currently undocumented workers, which would is a huge breakthrough for the American working class when it occurs. But in addition, we need a political movement that addresses housing for working people. I mean, that's very evident in California. I mean, that's the underside of liberal labor power in California is a huge housing crisis, but it's obviously a national one. But so is the daycare crisis. I mean, we have so many unattended needs for working people that one would think these would be at the very top of political discussion and reportage. Instead, nationally, we're obsessed with we're preoccupied with the question of our basic democracy, but often the commentators lose sight of the quality of life of people that are at stake in these political battles. And I'm afraid, our political leadership, even the AFL-CIO leadership, in my view, is not doing enough to make these salient, to drive home the centrality of these issues. So I think we have the makings, not only a manifestation at individual workplaces, but a more of a cross-cutting social movement, but we haven't fully seen its potential yet.
And John Logan, you've referenced a number of times this hour about leadership questions. The political scientist in me has been really thinking about this question about how much is the success or failure and the nature of the successes really on the leadership and the way the leadership frames issues and can organize versus a really kind of groundswell up where the leaders are just trying to respond to those needs. And what immediately comes to mind was the praise that was heaped upon Fran Drescher and the way that she framed the SAG-AFTRA strike around the corporate greed question, which linked it very, very much with other political issues. So is the secret better leadership, or is it just better groundswell, more of a groundswell of demand for union representation?
I think it's both of those issues. As you said, both with SAG-AFTRA, with UPS, Sean O'Brien, Teamsters, and now with Sean Fain, the new president of the UAW, who's clearly more militant, more to the left, and constantly talks about corporate greed. This is a change. I mean, it's only a few unions at the moment, but this is a major, major change in the culture of these unions, Teamsters and the UAW in particular. And as I said before, you can always say that, dynamism doesn't really come from the top. Like the head of the AFL has never been what's inspired labor activism and labor militancy. But I think that's true in the past, but we're at a moment right now where people, as I said, are crying out for bolder leadership, for inspirational leadership. And, the labor movement's never been good at communicating, but we do have some people. And as I said, O'Brien, I thought, was excellent. As you said, and I think the leadership of SAG-AFTRA has been very good during the strike. I think Sarah Nelson of the flight attendants is effectively this de facto president of this, young, more militant, more energized wing of the labor movement. But if you look at the Starbucks campaign, for instance, and this is true of many of the other organizing campaigns too, they're not top-down, centralized, bureaucratic campaigns that are dependent on full-time union staffers. I mean, this was the really inspirational thing about these campaigns, is that they were based originally, at least, on principles of decentralization, of respect for local autonomy. They spread so quickly through sort of rank and file dynamism. These are the campaigns that young workers want at the moment. They don't want someone to come along and organize them. They want someone to give them the tools that will allow them to organize themselves. So for them, you know, organizing is not something you read about. It's something you actually do. And so I think it does have to be a new style. And, you know, the problem is that, you know, I mean, I use this term labor establishment for want of a better term. But, you know, unions have these very set ways of doing things. They have structures. They have staff, lots and lots of staff. They have lawyers. They have revenue streams. They have interests. They have internal committees. And all of these things at this particular moment kind of prevents them from doing the one thing we want them to do, which is organize workers. Because lots of people, myself included, do believe that there's a chance right now that didn't exist before, that didn't exist 5 years ago, that didn't exist 10 years ago. We've been shown the types of campaigns that appeal to these workers, you know, like Starbucks, like Amazon Labor Union, like Trader Joe's United, you know, both of the latter are independent unions, like the kinds of campaigns that the RWDSU is running at Barnes & Noble and REI. So we know the types, as you say, they have to be these, they can't be top-down centralized campaigns that we've seen in the past. They don't work with this generation of young workers. You know, they want to be the ones doing the organizing themselves. But yes, they also do want inspirational leaders like Sarah Nelson, like Sean O'Brien, like others who will tell them, yes, we're going to help you stand up for corporate greed. We're going to help you get a fair deal at work and get respect and dignity at work. So I think, you know, we need both right now.
And Leon, we've been talking about the potential for a great awakening, but you had an observation that about the Democratic Party and their sort of delinking from labor. And that was actually fairly explicit in the 90s, where cultural issues were supposed to be much more important than economic issues for Democrats. I mean, the question here is, how much is the success of a potential great awakening also not just the labor leaders, but the recognition of, you know, political figures recognizing that there's a real power base out there, if they would just learn how to tap into it and become allies with labor in a way the Democratic Party really hasn't been in the last few decades?
I think, Doug, that there's a lot of simplifications running around the mainstream media about what are the main cleavages in the political culture today. And I'm just reading a piece by old David Brooks, New York Times, who thinks that the big difference, the big cleavage is between elitist liberals and the workers or the working class. And he's inclined to see, you know, that also defining the gap between the Biden Democrats and the Trumpists. And he misses, in doing that, he misses Lane and John's whole point about the college-educated working class. I mean, and the fact that the image of college educated people as being part of an elite, when in fact so many of them are really in precarious economic positions, is one of the problems with that framework. But so is the framework that pits economics, lunch pail politics versus all cultural issues or identity politics, when in fact most people's lives are really flow across lines of identity and material conditions. And I think any enlightened progressive movement has to come to grips with that, and come to grips in particular with the centrality of work in people's lives, as I suggested, on different levels, both the formal standards at their workplace, whether they have a union contract or not, but the wage, hours and conditions. This is going to be complicated by AI. It's complicated by the gig economy and the loss of full-time employment for most people. These are all big issues, and These have yet to be really fully embraced by a progressive Democratic Party, in my view. But that party needs to address the issues of immigration, issues of gender equality, but also a quality of life, quality at the workplace and beyond it, housing, et cetera. And I think that really we're talking about whether the Democratic Party can be, you know, effectively transform itself into a more social democratic party, addressing a broader community of needs, or whether the political culture of this country gets sandwiched back into very stale categories of liberals and elitists versus cultural conservatives and workers. I just think that's a no-go.
And with that, we're going to have to end our conversation. It makes me think sort of broadly the role that the unions are playing in the political culture, potential challenge that has within the Democratic Party. It's one that Democrats have wrestled with for quite some time, and one that after thinking, you know, the 2024 election is really going to be about the personality of the likely Republican candidate and old stale issues. Today's conversation suggests that there's a great deal of potential for some really interesting economic, cultural, maybe even not even drawing the distinction between culture wars and economic issues, but they're all intertwined together, and the rise of labor being a really important part of this ongoing political drama that we'll see playing itself out, not just in the next election year, but over the course of the next decade, even potential. Our panel today has been Lane Windham. She's the Associate Director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. She's the author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide, and the co-author of Explaining the Erosion of Private Sector Unions. John Logan is Professor and Chair of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State University. He's the author of Crushing Unions by Any Means Necessary, How Amazon's Blistering Anti-Union Campaign Won in Bessemer, Alabama, and recently has published a piece called A Model for Labor's Renewal, the Starbucks Campaign. And Leon Fink, Distinguished Professor in the Department of History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's the author of Workers Across the Americas, The Transnational Turn in Labor History, and In Search of the Working Class, Essays in American Labor History and Political Culture. Thank you all very, very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.